But first, we go to the border. The commissioner of U.S. Customs and Border Protection is ordering new steps to protect children in U.S. custody after the death of an 8-year-old Guatemalan boy. Felipe Gomez Alonso died just before midnight on Christmas Eve. He is the second migrant child to die this month after being detained near the border. The first, a 7-year-old girl, also from Guatemala, was buried yesterday in her hometown. She died in a U.S. detention facility from dehydration and septic shock. CBS News correspondent Janet Shamlin is in Alamogordo, New Mexico, where the boy is in the hospital with new details about his death.
Customs and Border Protection now reports that at about 9 o'clock Christmas Eve morning, detention center agents noticed 8-year-old Felipe Gomez Alonso coughing and appeared to have glossy eyes. By 12:45, he was at the hospital, diagnosed and treated for a common cold. At 1:20, he registered a 103-degree fever, but by 2:50, he and his father were released from the ER and transferred to another checkpoint with a prescription for an antibiotic and ibuprofen. Officials say the pair received several welfare checks there. But by 7 that night, the boy's condition worsened. He appeared to be nauseous and vomited, but his father declined further medical assistance. 3 hours later, authorities say Felipe was lethargic and nauseous again. An agent sent him back to the hospital as there was no EMT on duty. On the way, he lost consciousness, could not be revived, and was pronounced dead at 11:48 p.m.
This administration has put deterrence and enforcement ahead of humane treatment of people.
Chris Rickard is counsel for the American Civil Liberties Union, which is suing the government over its immigration policies. Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke spoke yesterday about the child's death.
I'm going to call for an investigation just to get to the facts, make sure we understand what happened, and to prevent something like that from happening again.
Alonso is a second child from Guatemala to die in Border Protection's custody this month. On Monday, family members wept as the body of 7-year-old Jacqueline Call was returned home. Rickert says the Department of Homeland Security and the president must be held accountable.
The question is, what does it take for DHS to take action? How many more children have to die before they are not put in these conditions?
The hospital cited privacy concerns for not giving out more information about Felipe's death, but they do say an autopsy is being done to learn how he died. Meanwhile, Customs and Border Protection says it isn't doing its own investigation. And as of this morning, the agency has ordered new wellness checks on every child currently in its custody, with an emphasis on those under the age of 10.
CBS News correspondent Janet Shamlin reporting from New Mexico. Now to Washington, D.C. President Trump says the partial government shutdown will not end until the Democrats agree to put up billions for his border wall. A large part of the federal government is still closed. The president is also backing his Treasury secretary after he caused more uncertainty.
Seattle's Morning News. Murray Morgan is probably best remembered around Seattle as the author of Skid Road, the history of the city's early decades, first published back in the 1950s. Some new editions of Morgan's books are now out, and historian Felix Bunnell is here to tell us about one of them, brought to us by the King County Library System.
Yeah, I caught up with my friend Michael Sullivan. You might remember, he's the Tacoma historian we met earlier this year when he shared all those cool images from a century ago from an unidentified photographer. He's Mr. Tacoma history, as far as I'm concerned. Anyway, Michael was tapped by UW Press to write a new introduction to Murray Morgan's 1979 book about Tacoma. It's called Puget's Sound. Murray Morgan was born in Tacoma in 1916 and grew up there. Michael Sullivan came to know him pretty well. They worked together on projects, and Morgan would visit the history class that Michael taught for UW Tacoma. Michael says that before Murray Morgan became a great regional historian, the guy and his wife Rosa were already being chased by world history.
History follows him around. He and his father went to the Olympics and were in the audience with Adolf Hitler when the boys in the boat won the Olympic gold medal. And then he and Rosa went back to Germany and were on the Rhine River when the Germans invaded Poland, and they had this kind of scary escape as young Americans from Budapest. Then he came back and was doing his master's degree at Columbia, ended up getting a night job at CBS and ran into Edward R. Murrow.
Yeah, and there have been plenty of books written about Northwest history over the last 150 years, but Michael Sullivan says there's something that to this day sets Morgan's books apart.
One of the things I think that makes Murray's style of history or his voice seem so contemporary today is that he almost has a cinematic way of looking at the events of the past.
And as far as that cinematic style goes, I mentioned that Murray Morgan would come and speak to Michael Sullivan's students at UW-Tacoma in the 90s. He says that the class was held in the Perkins Building in Tacoma, which overlooked the site of a notorious clash between laborers and the National Guard back in the 1930s. And when Murray Morgan told the story, the students were transfixed.
Murray just went right down through the building telling layers of stories like you were riding in a historical elevator. And by the time we got down to the ground floor and he started describing the labor struggles that day and the workers coming over the bridge and the National Guardsmen and all that stuff, with bayonets fixed, confronting them right in the middle of the street between the federal building and the newspaper offices. And he ended the story by going, yeah, and I remember my eyes still sting from that. And when he got to the end of the story, he realized he had been standing there up the hill as a young kid. He would have been, you know, 18 or so, and had actually witnessed it himself. So it was quite a amazing thing. For, you know, talk about bringing history right into the room. He had that gift.
Yeah, and you know, Skid Road is the best book about early Seattle history, and it's, you know, it's influenced generations of politicians. Every living Seattle mayor you ever talked to has read that book. And this next part that Michael talks about is sort of the, I think, the fantasy come true for any historian. He believes that Murray Morgan's influence goes far beyond college students or even local history enthusiasts. In fact, he sees Morgan's influence where he lives and works today.
I also look at Tacoma in the way that historic preservation, the way the city has its character and its the buildings, the urban design of the city seems to have a certain ingrained respect for history that I think Portland, Seattle, other cities, it's being lost in the shuffle a little bit. I think in part because of Murray and that sense of history that's so widely understood in Tacoma. I mean, everybody's read Murray's books, seems like. You know, it is influencing the character and the shape and the appearance and the culture of Tacoma even today.
Yeah, and there's that Murray Morgan Bridge. It's named for him. It's right there.
Which one's that?
It's right on Commencement Bay there. It's a bridge that he worked on back in the 1940s. He had some connection to it, so they named it after him back in the mid-90s when he was still alive to appreciate it.
Well, it's true that Tacoma seems to have escaped some of the excesses of urban renewal.
That's a nice way to put it. No, I love Tacoma just as much as anybody else, but this story about Tacoma and Seattle, the rivalry, Morgan gets into that a little bit. It really goes back to the 1890s and the arrival of the railroad pitting the two cities against each other and Northern Pacific investing in Tacoma, hoping they'd cash out or cash in, and Seattle kind of beating it. So it's been this long rivalry, and the fact that Morgan grew up in Tacoma, went to the UW, he straddled both worlds and was able to write intelligently about the whole area. And he passed away back in 2000 at the age of 84. The new edition of this book, Puget Sound, it's out from UW Press and a bunch of other his books. It's really worth checking out.
Very good. Felix Bunnell, brought to us by the King County Library System. Thank you, Felix.
Thank you.
Now, it's time for our Sports Insider from 710 ESPN Seattle, brought to you by Western Washington Toyota Dealers. In from the 710 ESPN bullpen, we have Curtis Rogers here to recap a spectacular Sunday night football win that guaranteed the Seahawks a spot in the playoffs.
On second down and 12, blitz is coming. Russell's going to let it fly. Far sideline. Got Lockett out there. Lockett reaches up. Does he hang on? He does! Holy smoke! What a pass to Tyler Lockett! Knocked out of bounds on the far sidelines at the 21-yard line. And Russell Wilson, as good as he is, could not have thrown that ball any better. Coverage was tight. The ball dropped right in from 45 yards for a first down. Ward was the man on coverage. What a pass in single coverage down the far side. Wow.
Hey, Curtis, how are you?
Doing good, doing good. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, of course. Okay, so were the Seahawks even expected to get into the playoffs this year?
See, that's so wild because at the beginning of the year, so many national voices out there had the Seahawks pegged for a 4-win season, a 5-win season, a 6-win season. And then when they started off 0-2, it seemed like, yeah, that was going to be the case. But then something clicked and something really got in these guys, and now they've turned it on, and they're going back to the postseason for the first time since 2016. It's truly a testament to the program that they have in place at the VMAC. And I think Seahawks fans are very, very excited, not just for this year, but I think this sets them up now for 2019, 2020, 2021. I think this is going to be more of a routine than 2017 was.
Okay, so what made it possible for the Seahawks to exceed? Because they were like, they were kind of looked upon as like, they're not going to do much this year, right?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing for the Seahawks in 2018 is the play of Russell Wilson. 2017, he was asked to do so much, and he ended up leading the league in touchdowns. But for whatever reason, the offense just never seemed to move in cohesion. They never seemed to really get the ball going. And this year, with the addition of the run game, it has allowed Russell Wilson to, I think, move more freely, to get his receivers involved more, and has taken a lot off his plate and has allowed him to play with such a freedom that we haven't seen him play with since the days of Marshawn Lynch.
Okay, so let's talk about the contribution of some of these younger players who are really, like, stepping up the game and really making a cohesive team based on, you know, they're just getting to know each other, right?
Yeah, the Seahawks, they've had some really good luck over the last couple of seasons in the draft. In 2017, the seventh round, a place where not many players are projected to do much, they were able to find their starting running back, Chris Carson, who's ran over 1,000 yards this season, first running back to do so since Marshawn Lynch in 2014. And then they were able to find David Moore, a kid out of East Central Oklahoma, really tiny school, who has come up with some huge catches for the Seahawks this season, has, I believe, 5 touchdowns. And then this year, Trey Flowers in the 5th round, a cornerback who has stepped alongside Shaquille Griffin and has really locked down his side of the field. The Seahawks are getting a lot of contributions from young players. Rashad Penny, the 1st-round pick this season, had a slow start to the season, but he's really picked it up when he's been healthy the last couple of weeks. The Seahawks are getting that next wave of talent that I think they were missing in the years like 2015, 2016, 2017, but I think it's here now.
Okay, so the million-dollar question, how far are they going to get into the playoffs?
I think they're going to go as far as Russell Wilson takes them, and I think that could be quite a ways. They're going to have a very favorable matchup in the wild card round because they're going to face a team that they've played already this season, whether it be the Dallas Cowboys, Chicago Bears, or Los Angeles Rams. It's going to be one of those three teams, and they've competed or beaten all three of those teams at some point this season. So I think they have a really favorable shot going up against either one of those teams. It's on the road, but the Seahawks have played every single opponent this season within a touchdown. They haven't been blown out at any point. So that means they've been in every single game. I think that continues in the playoffs.
And is bandwagon fever back in town?
I think so. I think so. You're going to start to see those like roadside stands with selling Seahawks gear coming up here. I think Seahawks fans are really, really showing out, and I'm excited to see all the crazies come back out.
Okay, one more question. The Seahawks won't have the home field advantage in the playoffs. What is that going to do to their mindset? They won't have their 12s at home.
You know what? I think Pete Carroll and John Schneider are able to get this Seahawks team so incredibly focused week in and week out. I don't think it really matters where they play. I think they're going to compete regardless of where they play, and I think they're going to give whatever opponent they have lots of fits, and that's just how this team operates. And you know, it's an incredible luxury to have such an incredible focus.
Okay, well, thank you, Curtis. As a bandwagon fan, I appreciate your little notes because I'm jumping on that wagon myself. I'm pretty excited.
All right, well, hop aboard.
Okay. That was Curtis Rogers from 710 ESPN Seattle filling in for Danny O'Neill. Our Sports Insider is brought to you by Western Washington Toyota Dealers. Now it's time for... This morning, we are sharing some of our favorite and timeless interviews from 2018. Amidst all the churn of political news out of Washington, D.C. and the White House, there is one issue the entire world faces that becomes more serious with each passing day. That issue is climate change. After the 4th National Climate Impact Assessment was released, Dave Ross spoke with Dr. Amy Snover, director of the University of Washington Climate Impacts Group.
So give us the lowdown. Last I heard, the timeline had been speeded up. They were now saying that it wasn't my grandchildren who would be experiencing climate change. It was me and my children who would be experiencing climate change firsthand. So where do we stand on that now?
You know, I think the current national climate assessment is really emphasizing the urgency and the immediacy of the climate change issue. So you're absolutely right. We've been thinking about this for a long time, and we often were talking about things that were happening, likely to happen further in the future. But I think what people don't really recognize and what this report really emphasizes is that climate change is an issue now, and it's affecting us now and will be affecting us now in many ways.
All right. So I guess to motivate people, well, first of all, here's what would motivate me to take fewer unnecessary trips. If gas was $20 a gallon, I would sit down and carefully plan out my next trip to the hardware store instead of going to the hardware store, you know, buying a can of paint and going back the next day buying a second can of paint, right? That's not going to happen anytime soon. But if you could scare me sufficiently about what the consequences are going to be, I might change without the price increase, although I really don't know. So what is – you're implying that there is something that no matter what we do is already baked in. Is that right?
That is correct, right?
Okay. So what is that? What does that look like for the Pacific Northwest?
So for the Pacific Northwest, like the globe, no matter what we do, we're going to experience warming, right? We have already committed to that as a world society, right? Because we've already changed the atmosphere. So we're going to see continued warming. And over the next handful of decades, the average temperatures will be warmer than the extreme highs in the past, right? So moving to a climate we haven't experienced. In the Northwest, our most important way of sort of storing water from the wet season when it arrives, when it rains and snows in the wintertime, to the rest of the year, when despite other people's perceptions, it doesn't rain and snow quite as much, is snowpack, right? So as it gets warmer, we have less mountain snow. And that's our natural reservoir. So that has more implications than I think people really always think about, right? So you can think about, we want water for drinking, right? So it's stored in the mountains in the winter, comes down the rivers, and is in the summer during our dry period, we use it to drink and water our lawns. Okay, so a decrease amount of water availability in the summertime for those kind of uses. We're not the only ones who use that summer water, right? There's fish that we actually care a lot about, and we have laws to protect them. And so decreased summer stream flow and warmer summer temperatures are bad for the cold water fish, like the salmon that we care a lot about.
I think the trouble is, the reason it hasn't gotten traction, the reason things like the carbon fee are voted down, is that when you ask about the cost, you never get a straight answer. People say, well, we can't tell you that now. And that's where the distrust comes in, because the straight answer, that everybody assumes in the straight answer is 50 cents a gallon, a dollar a gallon, $2 a gallon, European-style prices. Let me ask you this. Is there any way that you can tell people the unvarnished truth about what they have to do and have it still be politically acceptable, such that people would vote for such a thing?
So now you're asking a scientist to be a politician.
Well, and you know, unless you are, I don't think any of this is going to happen, right? Because you guys have been throwing the data at us for years. What you've predicted, this was this much I'll say, what you predicted has started coming true. Right? Even sooner than we thought. And are people moved by that still?
Well, I have seen more concern. Well, okay. So people, in my opinion, are not as moved by this as the urgency of the situation warrants. It's very alarming to look at the projections. I've been looking at these projections for over 20 years. And it was alarming to look at them when they seemed even to me like they were going to happen quite a while in the future. And to see it happening around you and examples of the kinds of problems we're likely to expect unfold where you live, in the places you care about, where people you know live, is really, really hard to see. And so I completely agree. We're not addressing this with the urgency it warrants. I think one of the hard parts about understanding exactly what to do is that we have to get out of the habit of thinking that this is something far off in the future that may or may not happen. This is here and now. This is being caused by our activities. Scientists around the world agree on this. We know that we're making a choice and we're every day we are making a choice, whether we realize it or not, to make the problem worse or to start making it better. And we have time and we have actions open to us if we do it.
And the stories that will continue into 2019. And now, a look at what nuclear war with North Korea would look like and whether the current administration can prevent it.
Dr. Jeffrey Lewis, who is an arms control expert, has written what I guess you could call a speculative novel. It's called the 2020 Commission Report, and it's written as a report by an official commission, a report on a North Korean nuclear attack on the United States that kills over a million people. And I have to ask you, this is a very scary book. I haven't read the whole thing, but by all accounts, this scares the pants off you when you read it. Why did you feel the need to write, and you're a bona fide expert, why did you feel you needed to write a novel about this?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. It turns out when you write nonfiction, it's very hard to rationally explain to people how two countries might do something that's crazy. And so it's much easier to show it and tell a story. And so I found that fiction was just a much easier way to convey all the ways that things could go wrong.
Okay, now the fiction part is the scenario that you outlined, but you based some of the things that happen on actual events, correct?
Yes. Everything that happens is a thing that's happened before. And, you know, although maybe some people would disagree, I don't think there are any great villains in the book. I just took real people and I had them do the kinds of things that they do every day. And I just let them keep doing that. But what I changed slightly was the context. And that helps illustrate how if we keep doing the things we're doing, we run some risks.
Okay, well, now, President Trump figures prominently in this book. And just in the interest of letting everybody know your bias here, let me read what you wrote in an op-ed in the Washington Post. I guess it was point in your book is that what sets off this final nuclear exchange is a Trump tweet. Can you tell us why that would be at all plausible?
Sure. Well, you know, it strikes me that it's strange that people would think it's not plausible. I mean, the reality is that what the president says matters. And foreign leaders look to what the president says as a way to get information in the same way that the normal people do. So what happens in the story is that there is a crisis, right? And there's a lot of tension. And the North Koreans are trying to understand what this crisis means, right? Does this crisis mean, you know, some sanctions, or does this crisis mean the beginning of an American invasion? And, you know, I think the tweet itself that I write in the book is quite mild, but it's the context that gives it meaning, and it's the context that causes the North Koreans to take it the wrong way.
But then what happens is North Korea launches its arsenal, and unlike some of the reports we've had that it doesn't work or it wouldn't survive reentry, it not only gets past our defensive missile system, but enough of them survive reentry to hit New York and Washington, which is a pretty major gaping hole in our defensive system. Now, is that part of the book based on reality, or were you making that up?
No. All of the quotes about the challenges with the ground-based missile defense, ground-based mid-course system in Alaska are true. In the book, I mentioned that there's a manufacturing defect, which there really is. And the Missile Defense Agency chose not to correct the manufacturing defect. They decided that going forward they would change it. But all of the interceptors sitting in Alaska have that same defect. And then the question is, in a crisis, if there is a launch, will it matter? We don't know.
All right. So I try to establish all this so people understand that even though this is a work of fiction, you have based this on things that could plausibly happen. So given all this and given your clear concern that there is considerable jeopardy here, how do you assess what has happened lately, which is that the Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's next meeting with Kim Jong-un, which he apparently was with the North Koreans, was called off by the president?
So what I think is happening right now is that the president really does want some kind of agreement. And I think no one on the president's staff believes that such an agreement is possible or that such an agreement is a good idea. I do think Mike Pompeo is heavily invested in this because it's kind of his signature issue. But what I think you're seeing is this kind of tension where the president promises that a deal will be struck and his staff doesn't think that's possible. And so I think this it's not a cancellation, it's a delay. But I do think that you are seeing the people around the president gradually trying to persuade him that this is not a good idea. And, you know, what the book explores is the idea of if this process collapses, if we don't have some kind of agreement, if we do go back to the situation we were in 2017 where there's a lot of pressure, how might that go wrong?
Well, I mean, reading about this book tells me that the president's right. You have to absolutely and completely denuclearize North Korea. I mean, wouldn't you agree with that?
Yes, but I would also like a pony. You know, the reality is that North Korea is not giving up its nuclear weapons. There is nothing in it for North Korea. They have the capability to hold the United States at bay, and no country has ever given up a capability like that. Of course, it would be best if North Korea were to denuclearize, but that's not the world we live in.
Okay, so in other words, we have to get used to the idea of North Korea being a nuclear power, something that Donald Trump has said he would absolutely not accept.
That's true, although, you know, the reality is he's the one person that does seem to be willing to accept it. I mean, he sort of says that he's not going to do this, but, you know, the president says one thing, but he does another. And as critical as I am of him, I actually think that dropping our insistence on denuclearization, which I think he has done in practice, although none of his staff agrees, that would be a good thing.
Really? So you are, in fact, encouraged by his approach. As critical as you are of him in this book, you're encouraged by what he's doing now in real life.
I think that he, yeah, I mean, I don't think the process is going to play out well. And I think in the end, he'll turn on a dime and he'll lash out at Kim and we'll be back to where we are in the book. So I'm very worried about it. So I wouldn't say that I endorse the process. But I do think that at some basic level, the idea that, you know, you've got to get in the room and you've got to talk to them, it's not wrong.
What would have to happen to assure you that this nightmare scenario is finally off the table?
Well, assure is a pretty strong word for somebody who studies nuclear weapons. I don't ever feel assured. You know, obviously, if North Korea gave up all the weapons, that would be fantastic. But as I say, I don't think that's going to happen. I think what you have to do is you have to get to a point where our relationship is different, where we don't feel like we are drifting into this kind of conflict. And what that really requires at the end of the day is making our peace with the fact that there is this, you know, pretty ugly regime in North Korea. It's not a pleasant thing, but kind of accepting that reality, getting U.S. policymakers to say, like, yes, this is not a good government, but it's not a government worth having a nuclear war over. Getting them there would make me much more comfortable.
Yeah, I think most people would be okay with that. I think we've given up this idea that we have to remake every nation in our own democratic image. But there also is this fear that Kim Jong-un is a crazy person who, without provocation, could fire off missiles like this. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I look at that pretty closely in the book. I don't think he's crazy. I think he's ruthless. You know, having his uncle executed wasn't insane. It was the right thing to do. It was just terrible, right? This is why neither you nor I are the bloodthirsty dictator of North Korea. Similarly, assassinating his half-brother, ruthless. What I consider in the book is the possibility that Kim Jong-un is learning all the wrong lessons, right? He is learning that in order to hold power, he has to be bold and aggressive, and he has to hit before his enemies hit him. That's one thing when it comes to rubbing VX in someone's face in an airport. It's another thing when it involves nuclear weapons.
You do also make it clear, though, with your graphic descriptions of the aftermath of this nuclear exchange, that this is the last thing you would ever want to subject your nation to.
Yes. You know, I'm a member of the governor of Hiroshima's roundtable on nuclear disarmament, and I go to Hiroshima every year. And so I've spent a lot of time reading the stories from people who survived that day and looking at what happened. And it would really be a tremendous catastrophe, even if one nuclear weapon were to go off in the United States, let alone the half dozen that I have happen in the book.
Dr. Jeffrey Lewis is the director of the East Asia Non-Proliferation Program at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies, and he also runs a website called armscontrolwonk.com because he is an arms control wonk. Dr. Lewis, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
It was a pleasure.
Good morning. I'm Carolyn Osorio, hosting Seattle's Morning News this morning. This hour of Seattle's Morning News is brought to you by Wilcox Family Farms. Coming up in this hour, we'll meet one of Washington's most famous historians, not named Felix Bonnell, but Felix will introduce us and why wage growth is weak while the economy is booming. We'll look inside the future of work and the gig economy. But first, the best of Seattle's morning news with Dave Ross and what the future of driverless cars could look like.
The day may come when driving will be illegal. And I know that's already got a lot of you upset, but that's the way it has to be because you, at some point, you can't keep adding more lanes to roads that already have five or six of them. Sam Schwartz has written a book about this, and he knows something about it because he was New York City's traffic commissioner, and I understand you earned the nickname Gridlock Sam. I assume that was intended as a compliment.
I think so. After I coined the word gridlock, it stuck to me like glue, and I can't seem to shake it, but I'm really anti-Gridlock Sam.
So you're the man who coined gridlock?
I did that during a transit strike in 1980, and the word took off, and I wish I had a nickel for every time it's been used.
Well, congratulations, I have to say. I did not know that, and it is an honor to meet the man who coined the term gridlock. So let's talk about that 1980 strike, because you began an experiment which actually informs a lot of what you're talking about today. So how did you deal with that strike?
Well, one of the ways, and it was quite successful, is we required three people per car on major highways. And even with all the subways out and for the first couple of days, all the railroads and all the buses out, traffic actually moved better on the notorious Long Island Expressway or Brooklyn-Queens Expressway than it does on a normal day. We could solve the traffic problem in almost any city if we doubled the occupancy. If in Seattle, the average car, instead of having 1.2 persons per car, had two people per car, you would see such a dramatic change in traffic. You'd have to set up speed traps during the rush hours.
Well, I mean, that would be great. And we've tried all sorts of ways to encourage that with express lanes and the rest. But people just want to drive themselves. You're saying, though, that autonomous vehicles are going to change all that and that eventually driving will be illegal. So how would that work?
Yeah, so in the beginning, the way I see it panning out, or the better way it could pan out, is that these become autonomous transit vehicles or shared vehicles. So we do away or minimize individual ownership of vehicles, and fleets deliver passengers, but not just one passenger per vehicle, two or three passengers per vehicle, or minibuses or micro transit, and we start seeing 10 or 15 people to do that last mile. That will relieve traffic a good deal. However, if we don't, and we just continue on the path we are with individual ownership, with average occupancies in the country right now under 1.1, and with autonomous vehicles, it'll drop below 1 since there'll be cars with no occupants, zombie cars out there, we'll have worse traffic. As far as banning driving, I think that's going to happen in the second half of the century, but already in the United States, there's a movement to preserve driving forever. Groups have been formed essentially saying, don't take my driving rights away from me ever.
Well, and if that movement succeeds, what's the likely result?
Well, we're going to see a tough 30 years no matter what. And the next 30 years we're going to have the conventional cars out there. We'll have cars, as we do today, with some autonomous features, and we're going to have cars that are fully autonomous. And pedestrians, whether it's downtown Seattle or Chicago or New York, are going to game the autonomous vehicles or assume the vehicles are autonomous, and they won't move very well going through city streets. They may move better on highways, but it's going to be chaotic. It's not unlike what happened at the turn of the last century when we had horses mixing with cars and streetcars and pedestrians all at the same time. We've got a pretty tough 30 years ahead before almost all vehicles will be autonomous.
But the idea that cities can keep growing and keep building more roads, I don't see how that's... I know it's not possible in New York. You can no longer expand the Long Island Expressway. And there are the I-5 through Seattle can't be widened unless you move the entire city. At some point, people are going to have to accept passengers or just live in a dorm at work, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. And people will live further out. They will feel driving will be less of a burden, even if they're stuck in traffic for an hour or so, because it will be your living room. It will be your bedroom. You'll get that extra sleep. So there is a concern it can make traffic a lot worse unless we require multi-occupant vehicles.
I see. So this is the other thing in your book, where your car becomes your apartment, essentially. It's a, you can, there could be a bed in it or a cot. You could sleep in it. You could even spend overnight in the city if you had to. And if people deal with the commute that way, that's where the trouble would begin, huh?
Yeah, yeah. You know, if people want to sleep in their car, get an extra half hour or hour of sleep and have the car delivered to them. I don't know if we'll put showers in the cars, but if you have a shower at work, you could absolutely do that. And, you know, maybe it'll deal with some of the homeless population as well. But it's going to be a huge change, and it could unfold in a good way, a bad way, or an ugly way.
Sam Schwartz, author of the new book, No One at the Wheel, and the man who coined the term gridlock. It's more of the most compelling Dave Ross interviews from 2018 and a look at the changing nature of the job market. While the economy is cranking, salaries are slack, and the gig economy may explain why.
Professor Lewis Hyman wrote a recent op-ed in the New York Times. Just quote a line from it because I think a lot of you are going to identify with this. He writes, "For the vast majority of workers, the freedom of the gig economy is just the freedom to be afraid." He's written a book called Simply Temp because that describes the kind of job that a lot of you have today. So, Professor Hyman, do we have good stats on the percent of the workforce that now simply has is simply making their living with going from job to job, temporary jobs?
It's at least 10% and probably more on the order of 30% of the workforce that is in this new kind of freelance or gig or temp economy.
Now, I know that people bring people blame technology for this. You don't blame technology for this. So what's your overall feeling about this change in the workforce? Is this a good thing or a bad thing?
Yeah, people often point to apps and to Uber as the cause of insecurity in our workforce. In the book, I write about how I say that Uber is the waste product of the service economy, that the alternative to Uber is not a good union job or a stable office job, but working as a barista, slinging coffee, or trying to get enough hours at a Walmart. And I think that that is the real experience of working people today. And if we want to look at the gig economy, it's certainly helping those people make ends meet, but it's not the ideal situation for most people like that.
It strikes me that these people are living the life of an actor, which has always been a gig economy, right? You're only as good as your latest audition. And to me, that's no way to live. I know a lot of people do it, but I can't imagine knowing that for the rest of my life, my job could end with a phone call tomorrow and I have to go out and search for a new one, you know, two, three, four times a year.
Well, I think the terrifying part for most people is that there's no safety net. There's no backup plan. You know, most Americans don't have $400 to pay an emergency bill. And that's important to realize that people want to have a sense that if their job falls through, they'll have a place to sleep that night and be able to feed their kids the next week or get health care. And so many of our benefit systems, unemployment, health care, retirement, are tied to employers, to this older economy that, you know, for a large fraction of our population is not where they are living right now. And that's the real challenge.
So does it have to be this way? Or is this simply a trend that requires the government to step in with a new kind of safety net?
I think there's a lot of different choices, but we have to make a choice. I don't think that it has to be inevitably a race to the bottom, a world of fear, just like the industrial economy. We have, for 100 years, if you said manufacturing job, you weren't thinking, oh, that sounds great. I'm nostalgic for that. You thought, oh, that's Dickensian wages, immiseration, starvation, and maybe I'll lose my arm in a machine. Yet we figured out ways to make that work for everybody through unions, through laws, through new ways of running our corporations, through visionary business leadership. And I think we need to do the same thing today in making the independent workforce work for everybody.
Which would mean some kind of union that unionizes independent workers based on their status, regardless of what craft they happen to be in. I mean, how would that work?
Well, I mean, what you just said, the craft that you're in is exactly what happened in the Great Depression. So in the middle of the Great Depression, the CIO decided they were going to organize, you know, auto workers who were largely unskilled, and never before in American history had unskilled workers successfully organized. And yet in the middle of the Great Depression in 1936, the UAW forms, United Auto Workers, and they face down the largest corporation in the world, General Motors, and they win a contract. And it's on this basis that we get, you know, the great forging of the post-war middle class for working Americans. So today, you know, as we think about a distributed independent workforce, yeah, it may not look like the AFL or the CAO, but there's always a need for workers' voice and for workers' power to contest that of monopoly power at the top.
So you're saying there are choices here, but I'm guessing, I mean, I don't see millennials rushing to join unions. And in fact, I think they're afraid of joining unions because if they're identified as a troublemaker, they could get, I mean, since all hiring is done on computers, you could easily blacklist somebody and that name would populate every job hiring site. And pretty soon you're living under a bridge.
Well, I guess it depends what we mean by a union. You know, certainly coworker.org is a good counterpoint to that. So coworker.org is just a website where people can gather and talk to each other across different places. So a few years ago, Starbucks employees, speaking of millennials, you know, lots of them have tattoos and they couldn't show them at work. And they gathered on coworker.org and they began to write petitions and push back, and Starbucks changed its policies. Well, it might sound a little silly or trivial about tattoos, but from that they began to organize and push back for wages and benefits and other kinds of things. And so, you know, it's possible to organize through the internet, and we're just at the beginning of that. People trying to figure out how to use technology to push back against a distributed employment relationship.
You point out that the reason the gig economy developed, again, was not technology, but it was corporations that were worried about the, we're trying to satisfy investors who are looking always at the bottom line, really don't care what happens to the workers as long as the company makes money. And they found it more efficient to be able to hire and fire a bunch of independent contractors rather than have lifelong employees. But if what people really want is security, how do they achieve that themselves without some kind of help from a central authority? I don't know that a website like the one you described would be enough to do that. I mean, are we really basically stuck with the gig economy until there is some sort of overall economic reform here?
In the book, I write about both a left-wing and a right-wing, a liberal and a conservative approach to solving this problem. And the first step is acknowledging that this independent workforce is real. It is big, and it has problems that are different from older kinds of work relationships. And so part of that answer can be the government. Part of that answer can be the private sector. But we need to figure out ways to decouple our benefits and our security from employers and figure out ways to connect it to the workers themselves, so that as people move from gig to gig, from job to job, or combine jobs in multiple ways, they are able to have some security in their lives.
Professor Lewis Hyman has written a book. It's called Temp, T-E-M-P, How American Work, American Business, and the American Dream Became Temporary. Professor Hyman, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your time.
And now, as 2018 comes to a close, one of the biggest mysteries we'll carry into the new year is what exactly Robert Mueller has uncovered and to what extent Russians influenced the 2016 election. Here's Dave Ross.
There are still some things we don't know about the hacking of the 2016 election, and that's what Kathleen Hall Jamison has taken on. She teaches communication at the University of Pennsylvania, and she's written a book called Cyber War, How Russian Hackers and Trolls Helped Elect a President. And Kathleen, was there something about the Russian intervention that rises beyond what normal, everyday, unorganized trolls could do if they want to affect an election?
Yes, what surprised me as I did the research for this book was the extent to which the trolls, that is, the people marauding around in cyberspace, as opposed to the hackers who stole Democratic content. What I was surprised about the trolls was the extent to which they had a clear theory of the election. It wasn't just cacophony. And they aligned with themes that were central to the Trump rhetoric. They aligned with the audience needs, that is, the groups that he needed to mobilize, demobilize, and shift. And they used evocative visual content, much of it simply repurposed from what they found within the U.S. in the more extreme conservative sites. But that was evidence of an organized effort that was actually highly strategic. And I was surprised at how strategic it was. I didn't expect to find that.
Well, now, this was happening from the Russian troll farm, right?
Yeah, in St. Petersburg.
Okay, so how did they gain? They must have had an intimate knowledge then of American culture to pull this off convincingly. Where'd that come from?
Yeah, and that's the second really interesting question. If you pay any attention at all to media, you will learn which states are in contention, which voting groups need to be mobilized, where the worries about turnout are. And I quote in the book extended passages from things that are online, that are our press, hence available to anyone who speaks English within the global web, that essentially give you a guidebook. And that's way number one. Way number two is we know the Russians stole voter data. They stole turnout models. And we also learned that they had the complete Democratic voter plan as part of one of the hacks. We learned that from the last Mueller indictment. We do know it was in Russian hands. And so that's a second possibility. So apart from being able to read about it and then also figure it out because you've got some Democratic content that is telling you how the campaigns are strategizing, you also have a scenario in which the social media platforms make it really easy to find voter groups because they're really set up to sell us to advertisers. And so the demographic categories, once you know what they are pretty easy to reach by social media.
Right. But, I mean, the political consultants have access to all this, too. In fact, they originate a lot of it. So what's the difference between the Russians exploiting this material to affect the election and the parties themselves exploiting this material to affect the election?
That's a really important question. And the argument that I make in the book is that differences in amount of material matter. So essentially, they are aligned with the Trump messaging. And had the same messaging come in from the U.S., it simply would have been more messaging on behalf of Trump legitimately placed there. But when you increase the amount of content and it's more negative than it otherwise would be, you can shift votes on the margin. You don't get massive effects out of it, but you can shift votes on the margin. And we saw that in work that I did on the 2000 election, which, as you know, was closer than this one,
right,
where we showed that changing in amounts of messaging could make a difference to account for why one candidate won the popular vote and the other won the Electoral College. So by changing the amount and the amount of negativity, they could plausibly create this effect. And as a result, if you take all of the stupid things that Hillary Clinton's campaign did and all of the dexterous or stupid things that Donald Trump's campaign did, and you bake them all in, and then ask, could that change in the amount have affected 78,000 votes? The answer is, if they got it to the right demographic groups in three states, it could. But we don't have the information to know whether they did that. The platforms know that, and I wish they'd tell us that. We do know that the hacked content reached voters across the United States, largely with the complicity of our media.
And that's what this boiled down to, then, 78,000 votes.
In three states.
In three states. Well, I mean, sunspots could have changed that, right? That's tiny.
Yeah. When people try to explain the election, there are all sorts of things you could say could have changed the outcome. Hillary Clinton could have gone to those states.
Yeah.
Hillary Clinton could have not said deplorable. Hillary Clinton could not have said it was allergies when it was instead pneumonia. All of those things are already baked in my set of assumptions. And the question is, if all of those are there, if everything else is exactly the same, and you add the trolls, and you change the message balance in the computers of some individuals aligned with Trump's messaging, and in the hacked intervention, you change the agenda in the media so that things happen in media that couldn't have happened without the hacking, is that enough to swing that number of votes? And the answer I came to, and it surprised me because I didn't see all of this put together before I did the research, was there's enough change in the media agenda and in the content of the last two debates to say that if everything else is a constant, there's enough of a stimulus there to actually make the difference. It's not a certain case. It's a case that says it seems to me to be pretty likely.
Kathleen Hall Jameson, UPenn professor and author of Cyber War, How Russian Hackers and Trolls Helped Elect a President. It's 8:52, time now for Cairo.